everyone. This is Jerry Fabian, KYGTLPFM 102.7, 103.9 on the air. Doing back-to-back here on Writer's Talk on the rabbit hole. I'm loving it. Oh, my gosh. We just had an hour conversation here. Bonnie McCune. Thanks, Bonnie. Safe travels back to Denver. And talking about her work. And in the studio with me right now, Stephen Craig. Steve, you want to say hey?
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to Idaho Springs.
All right. And we're going to get chatting about your work here in a few moments. Waiting for Today. And interesting, fantastic story. It's intriguing. Before we go on, though,
that's a great introduction, by the way. Thank you.
Oh, absolutely. That'll, be a beer. No.
I'm gonna owe you more than a six-pack before
I work cheap, But I do want to thank all our sponsors, and I brought you the last hour. This hour is being brought to you by Dex. If you need any information, DexKnows.com, 1-800-CALL-DEX for all your needs. I want to give a special shout-out to our founder, one of our founders, co-founders here, Greg Markle, for everything he's done, because without Greg, we wouldn't have this studio, this fantastic situation here that we can come on in and just chat it up here and, listen to great music, alternative music. It's, in a special part of the universe. So, Steve,
True gem. Yeah, this is my first time inside this studio, actually.
All right. And, we're good. So, you got a book out now, Waiting for Today.
Yeah.
Tell us about it a little bit.
Yeah, the typical elevator pitch to start with is it's the story of a man who loses what he loves most and inevitably must find a way to believe in love and life again. It's a man who goes through immense tragedy and has to come out on the other side still seeing the beauty that life has to offer. And so if you look at the back tagline of the book, it's believe in life again. And it's Waiting for Today is my attempt to instill that in audiences worldwide, to try to get them to see the beauty that life really does have to offer, even despite its tragedies and the suffering that go along with it.
Okay. What inspired you to do this?
It's a really good question, Jerry. To be honest, it goes back 20 years when I was a far younger man with a lot less gray. And I was on a bus trip coming back from Boston and going back to Vermont. And in the midst of that, I was listening to a song off the Tiger Lily album by Natalie Merchant, if you're familiar at all. And it was a song that started getting me to think, what would your life be like if you lost what you loved most? It was funny. You and I were chatting earlier this morning just casually about what the book was about and asked whether or not how much of the story is autobiographical. And it's not. Like, I, to be honest with you, that's, to me, is the beauty of fiction, is to be able to understand and conceive of a premise that's at times fictional, despite the fact that it has some correlation to real life. But to me, an essential premise gets back to, if you know the book of Job at all from the Bible, and I'm not, by no means am I a biblical scholar, but the story of Job always fascinated me. And the reason why is with Job, inevitably gets to the heart of why do we as human beings suffer? The story goes that God and the devil are sitting, casually chatting one afternoon and decide that the devil tells God that the only reason that Job was truly faithful to you is because you've given him everything. And if you took everything away from him, he'd turn on you in a second. And so inevitably they engage in that sort of wager and they do. God tests Job by taking everything from him. Poor guy ends up with boils at the end of it all, never mind losing his kids, his wife, the whole deal. And it begs the question of why do we suffer? Is there a meaning to our suffering? And it's a universal question throughout time. And I always found that the Bible's answer to that question was wholly unsatisfactory. That inevitably it gives the answer that every mediocre parent gives to their kids when their kid asks them why. Because I said so. And the reason is that, to be honest, the folks who were writing the Bible had no better insight into that than we do. And when writing Waiting for Today, I tried to answer that question to give meaning to suffering where there seems to be none.
Mm-hmm. And, so when you're I'm detecting, because I want to get more into the work itself.
Yeah.
But about you personally, a bit of a philosopher.
Oh, very much. yes, I'd like to think so, but perhaps give myself too much credit for it. Yeah.
Who are your in your first of all, what's your background?
Well, I was a teacher for 15 years, went to, obviously, I was an English teacher for 15 years and loved philosophy. Like, it, to be honest, to me, the two are interwoven in a way that's really interesting. And it was the philosophy behind so much literature. So I wrote my master's thesis on Thoreau and Emerson and Whitman. And so those, it was that kind of writing that I really, now, grant you, I also love beautiful prose. So I love the terms that it's in, but to me, what really sparked my imagination with fiction and why I love teaching it were ideas, the ideas that inevitably come from fiction. And so, yes, I do. I love philosophy. And, you know, if you're, you know, and to be honest, I don't necessarily, when you say who would you ascribe your philosophical leanings on, one of the things I think that's beautiful when you reach a certain point of philosophy is that you realize that seemingly contradictory philosophy is not necessarily mutually exclusive, that you can, in fact, believe in people like the transcendentalists and at the same time ascribe to some of Nietzsche's ideas or something along those lines. And I find, that's why I found in your title, Sisyphus. I love Albert Camus, the myth of Sisyphus. Mm-hmm. One of my favorites, and the idea that that inevitably, Camus and the existentialists suggest that there's meaning in nothing, and I don't necessarily think that's somehow or another inconceivable, along with the idea of some things in this world, inevitably, that there is a reason that we suffer.
Yeah, and I remember when we were talking once, and I had brought up Kurt Vonnegut, Kilgore Child's
right.
book.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've been able to dig it out yet.
He's more whimsically existential. I love, if you go back to Slaughterhouse-Five, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, Slaughterhouse-Five, a great novel, and one of my roommate when I was in graduate school is from Dresden.
Okay.
It was just fascinating, right? He had never read the novel, and of course the novel is about the firebombing of Dresden.
Right.
And if you've ever been to Dresden, the town was decimated, mm-hmm. And has been built back beautifully since World War II to some degree. But to find, humor, to somehow or another find humor in the meaninglessness of it all, it was, I think, Vonnegut's pure gift of it.
And when Bonnie and I were talking earlier, she raised the concept of a dystopian type of novel. Do you right. put Vonnegut there? First of all, define it. As an English teacher, you're a pro at this now.
This is what happens with two English teachers.
Exactly. we're having a discussion now in class here. So how would you define dystopian, and then would you put Vonnegut there?
That's a really good question. I think I would think that his vision in Slaughterhouse-Five is dystopian. I think that a dystopia to me is a universe that's almost just like a utopia is universally positive. I think a dystopia is a world that has gone universally, either universally chaotic or universally wrong. And I do think that I would define Slaughterhouse-Five as a dystopian novel, but with a objective look at it with a sense of humor and mm-hmm. looking back and saying, this is what you get. This is the way the universe is. You can either sit there and dwell in your misery, or you can have a good laugh at the expense of the universe and sort of sit back and chuckle. And I guess I wouldn't say that my novel is all that different in that regard, in the sense that I too see that suffering is an inherent part of this universe. Like it's not going to end. There's a scene in the book where Faith is trying to convince Jacob to have a child, and he's like, well, what if this goes wrong? What if this goes wrong? She's like, not only am I telling you that things that at some point or another, things will go wrong. And that's a part of the universe that you have to accept, is loss and suffering are an inherent part of this experience. You have a choice to embrace life anyways, or you can sit there in a hole and suffer and dwell about it.
I want to read you a line from your novel because
you're going to quote me back to me.
You didn't bring a copy, but I did, and it ties in kind of here. This just jumped into mind, and I went through and highlighted and bookmarked and so forth here. But at any rate, you write, life is full of binary opposites. But Jacob smirked at the thought that humans can only understand concepts through their corresponding counterparts.
Right.
You have a couple things there. One, explain what you mean by that. Life is full of binary opposites we can only do. But Jacob smirked at the thought. I'm curious about him smirking at that thought. I would think he would agree with that. I don't know.
That's a really good point. And by the way, that the point that you brought up in the novel has – I don't know if he would have smirked at the – that's his growth as a character, is that by the end of the novel he is able to smirk at that binary opposition.
Okay.
It's earlier in the novel that he cannot cope with the idea of tragedy and loss, and it's his growth to accepting and embracing both that inevitably resolves him as a character. But in terms of what I mean by that, if you know a little bit about deconstructionist literary theory, which probably most people listening may not, but you and I do, and but the idea of deconstructionism is that everything, we only understand abstract concepts through their opposite, day and night. I wouldn't, if I only sat here and it was day 24 hours a day, we would never understand what day really was because there would be no contrast through it with night. The same thing with good and evil. If every single person in this world were good and we only saw good acts, we would never understand the concept of what good was because we wouldn't understand it to its counterpart. And the same thing is true, I believe, of suffering, that if we didn't have suffering in this world, we would have no idea and no appreciation or concept of what joy was. It would be a benign experience that we sort of accepted as part of the day-to-day life. It's suffering, that the meaning of suffering comes in that it provides the counterpart to joy. And without that suffering, it's the amount of suffering that we have that inevitably informs our joy. And that's why I use the Red Sox as a metaphor.
For those of you who have been suffering for eternity, only greater than the Chicago Cubs, by the way.
And I did. I was I cried myself to sleep. If a couple of my friends from back home are listening who are also devout Red Sox fans, I was having been born in 71, I cried myself to sleep the night that Bill Buckner let that ball go through his legs in 1986. And I have I grew up in Connecticut, and that's one of those details I did take from my own life and use for Jacob. But I thought the Red Sox experience was really telling in exactly what I'm talking about. I have a lot of good friends back home. Half of them are Yankee fans, half of them are Red Sox fans. And my buddy Jeff, who's a lifelong Yankee fan, when I once told him, "You'll never understand the joy I felt in 2004. You guys won 27 World Series, maybe more at this point. Like you don't understand. Like to you, really, right. When you don't win a World Series, you're kicking the dirt and going, oh, you know. But like when you win one, I don't think George Steinbrenner spent a really happy evening in his entire life. He either expected to win, or it was pure misery, and so he never understood the joy, the elation when 2004, and it couldn't have happened in a more magical context. But any Red Sox fan will tell you that their joy was informed by whatever period of their life they had spent watching the Red Sox lose time after time after time after time, and so when they finally won in 2004. Their joy was all the more enormous for that, having gone through that suffering. And that's why it's such a perfect metaphor for Jacob, that in the end he comes to recognize that it is only because he has suffered that the joy that he has inevitably brought in his life is so euphoric.
And I was going to ask you, and you're addressing it in large part, Stephen, the role of baseball in the story itself, how metaphoric it is, you're talking about it because it does set up that suffering there. And those of us, I'm not a huge baseball fan as I am in football, but I know enough that, with baseball, in Boston, it compares it to the Yankees. There's the good and the evil right there. I think you can say that in the novel. You bring that up. So it's not a cultural thing, but it's also, like with Jacob and his struggles in life and everything too. But I find that baseball, because I tell you, one of the most endearing scenes I read in the story was Jacob, as a little boy, going to the Red Sox Fenway Park with his dad, you know, that whole thing. And, you know, you're kind of like falling in love with this little guy here because it was so authentic.
It's what redeems him as a character, I think, is that, you know, because he's difficult at first. Jacob is a difficult character in that he sees so much of the dark side. And I can't tell you, a lot of people are like, I just want to give him a kick in the rear and tell him to cheer up. But it's that scene with his father that I think really starts to define him and gives you emotional interest.
Is it a loss of innocence then?
I think absolutely. You know, and of course, it's early on in the book, so I can give that away. But he loses his father shortly after that scene. And you start to understand the context and perspective that he brings to life and why he feels that way. It's funny about baseball because, to be honest with you, I loved baseball growing up as a kid. I played a little bit. But let's face it, it's almost like watching paint dry. We could all go to Coors Field. It's starting. Baseball is starting. And, you know, I'll bring my kids to a game this year. But baseball inherently is slower. It's not nearly. I prefer football any day of the week. But the Red Sox are a bit different in the sense to me that it's almost like a religion.
Yes.
And it's And I'm extremely excited. I'm actually bringing my kids this year, where my parents still live back in New Hampshire. And so we're headed. This will be my first time bringing my kids to a game at Fenway Park. They've been to a game at Coors Field. And to me, that feels different. To me, there's something about baseball. There's something tactile about being present in the stadium. Like, for me, turning on a baseball game at home, that is a slow paced.
There's something
tedious.
Sacred, I think, what we're getting at here, because it's more than just a bunch of guys out there running around playing a boys' game, and they're adults and they should know better, sort of thing. There, I get it in this context here, right. 1998 when the Broncos won their first Super Bowl. Oh my God, we were tearing it, you know, like, oh my, you know.
Oh, absolutely.
It was, you know, equated to that there. But this, and on Thursday, I don't know if I'm going to make it for sure, but I was given two tickets to the Rockies. I haven't been to a Rockies game in forever. It's like, yeah, you say, I can watch photosynthesis. It's more exciting sometimes. But interesting enough, when these were offered to me, it's the Pittsburgh Pirates. And I grew up with the Pirates. And, you know, and there's a special place in my heart, at least for back then, and my hero was Roberto Clemente. And, you know, years ago, my sister gave me a cap and a T-shirt with Clemente on. Now, you know, I live in Colorado. I'd be a Rockies fan. But there's something nostalgic about it. It would take me back to that boyhood going into, for us, it was Forbes Field before there was Three Rivers.
Right.
And watching Roberto out there, there's something sacred about that. And I think that's one of the more of the powerful aspects of your writing in this particular story here.
Right.
And if people, while they're reading, and I certainly encourage everybody to be reading Stephen's work here, is to hone in on that idea of the baseball and the role it plays, and then translate that into your own lives. What is sacred for you that for everyone else might be simply trivial or, you know, superficial?
Right. You're absolutely right. Baseball has that ability within the American context. And why, it's interesting. It is slower paced. It does have that aspect to it. It's one of the reasons, for example, in having been a Northeast transplant, I too am a Broncos fan. I've given up, and I still root for the Patriots, but I can transform that. I'll never root for. And I was at the World Series final game four, you know, when the Red Sox won here in 2007. There's no way I was rooting for the Rockies over my Red Sox. Like that, there is a sacred aspect of that. There are some things that transform the physical space and game that they're being played by just a bunch of men. It really turns itself into almost this sort of spiritual. And you take a look at it in that building, and that's why I tried to make that metaphor pretty clear with when they go to the game at Fenway, that's almost its own spiritual cathedral. Much as you know that much as Emerson and Thoreau found their spiritual cathedral within the entire natural world within them, to some degree or another, Jacob finds it at Fenway Park.
Is suffering then a gift?
suffering is a gift.
It's tough to put your arms around it, but explain why.
It's easier for me, and this is where, you know, I've been asked how much of the story is autobiographical, and for me, it's not. My father's still here. I haven't endured the tragedy, at least not the same types of tragedy that Jacob has experienced. And so it's easier for me philosophically to approach that idea of what is suffering and to actually help people. And that's what the novel's geared towards, is trying to help people truly embrace suffering as important a part of their lives as the joys and tribute and triumphs are. But it's, wow, when you're in the midst of that tragedy, when you've just lost someone that you love, when you've been lost an opportunity that you've had, it's awfully difficult in that moment to sit there and embrace the tragedies that befall us.
Yeah, and you write in the story here on that. And I'll put in context of, because one of the dangers for us as human beings, and we all do it, right, to fall into self-pity.
Right.
That my suffering is greater than anyone else's.
Well, I think Jacob does. In a complete fairness, and I think that's one of the things that's frustrating for him as a character. He falls into a sort of martyrdom, and that's why his mother is a character in the book as well, is that his mother absolutely allows herself to become consumed in that self-pity. What is the end game of that self-pity? Further and further cycling into the drain of misery and depression. And that is a choice that you have, and there are plenty of people out there. We live in a society that loves to dwell in its own self-pity. And inevitably, that's your choice, and you have every right to go down that road, but the only one who's going to inevitably pay the consequence for that is you. We all know people who have lived lives of quiet desperation and misery. And that's why his character is sort of – her character is meant to be a foil for Jacob's road. He comes to that sort of crossroads, if you will, that sort of frost, two roads diversion of wood, and he gets to choose which road he's going to live. And he sees his mom and the path that she's chosen of self-pity and martyrdom as one particular option. And then a very special woman comes into his life by the name of Angie, and who inspires him to inevitably realize that, yes, I will have faith in life. I will gravitate back towards living, even though I know that in embracing life, that when I have connections with others, it's an inherent part of life is loss. Mm-hmm. It's interesting. I know you two have a bit, not only do we share the transcendentalist, but we share a little bit of Eastern philosophy as well. And one of my favorite things about Eastern religion is take in Buddhist terms, the word dukkha. And dukkha is a really interesting concept. And if you translate the term, it means two things. It means suffering and desire. Mm-hmm. And to Buddhists, those are one and the same. Mm-hmm. We suffer because we desire. Mm-hmm. Because inevitably, as long as there are two things about desiring anything, either you'll desire it and not get it and be really bummed about that, mm-hmm, right? And that's inevitably that space between what we have and what we want causes suffering. Or you will obtain and have things in your life. Say you fall in love with the love of your life. You're together for 50 years. And they die before you. Mm-hmm. Inevitably, all that you have in this world is everything in this world is transitory. And mm-hmm, thus, by definition, it loss is an inherent part of this world. It always will be. Mm-hmm. And I remember it brought me really powerfully to a scene in your book in which your protagonist is talking about the idea of that this world is never permanent. Mm-hmm. And that this world is constant, and that we have what kind of brazen thought do we have to sit there and believe that we as human beings can instill permanence on it? You can't. But you have a choice. You have a choice to knowing that you will lose things and that loss is a part of life. You can decide that you can disconnect from the world and thus suffer no pain, mm-hmm, or you can decide to embrace it anyways and experience both the joys and the sorrows together.
And Jonathan expresses it in my story there, and he says that into every life, pain will come.
Right.
Suffering, on the other hand, is optional.
it's such a great line. Yeah. I was going to ask you about where do you see the distinction between those two concepts, pain and suffering?
Pain is something that's inflicted on us. You know, you stub your toe.
Pain's the external event.
It's what we feel.
Okay.
No, it is internal.
Okay.
But it tends, and it can be psychological.
Okay.
If someone calls you, rips you apart in public, demeans you, that's painful.
Right.
Humiliation. Jonathan talks about that in the story.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay. Shame. That's humiliation. You're in an automobile accident. That hurts. That's pain. Now, the suffering for me is that dwelling on it. Poor me, self-pity. And instead of, this hurts, and it's not pleasant to go through, but you know what? I'm going to go through it. Does that mean you're going to start dancing on your toes in the next 20 seconds? Hell no.
No.
Yeah, no. You have a lot of work to do. But to do the main challenge, I think, confronts the human, the individual. And going to Jung over here now, Carl Jung, is, what is the problem here, is to, and we'll go back to Job in the Old Testament too, an answer to Job. I love this stuff here. But our main challenge is to avoid falling into the pit, the sand pit of self-pity.
Right.
And to believe that my tragedy is greater than anyone else's, or poor me, the universe is against me. Because you're right. When I was reading this novel, I wanted to grab Jacob and just shake him.
Right.
And say, get the over it, get a grip here, guy.
Right.
It's
true. My girlfriend said the same thing. It was funny. She was, we were talking about it the other day, and she was like, that was the hardest part of the novel for me. And mm-hmm. And I think that that's true. And it was intentional for Jacob to be a difficult. He was, it's almost the... I wouldn't call him an anti-hero, but he, to some degree or another, he is a very flawed protagonist. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that he's redeemed at the end of the novel. But I do think that his stubborn self-pity throughout a good portion of the novel is difficult. And that's supposed to be awakening for us. Because as much as we might want to shake Jacob, sometimes we need to shake ourselves out of that same self-pity.
Yeah, and he recognized in this a little bit of lines here, you write, and my eyes are a little blur. I know it's not much condolence at this point, but at least you got to love like that once. If only for a limited time. She took his hand in hers and gave it a gentle squeeze. The point struck home with him. While he had every right to mourn the loss of his sacred love, perhaps he should find some solace in knowing that he even had faith, and that's uppercase F,
right,
faith.
Yep.
Okay, we're going to come out because I want to ask you all about this here. That he had faith, that is his first wife, in the first place. Perhaps there was a debt of gratitude that had yet to be paid. That's powerful.
Thank you. I couldn't agree more. It's funny. It almost begs the line of the 80s hairband Poison. It's better to have loved and lost than never have loved at all. Mm-hmm. I hate to be quoting Bret Michaels when talking, but it is. It's a great point that we sometimes in the wake of the loss of something, forget to have a stop and have the appreciation of having had the moment in the first place. Mm-hmm. And nothing, again, that gets back to that idea that nothing in this world is permanent. Mm-hmm. Everything that you have at some point or another will be lost, including our own youth and vitality, including the people that we love in life. And you have to love anyways.
Yeah, I believe the second law of thermodynamics is that everything that comes to order is destined for entropy.
Yes.
And it's going to fall apart. As soon as it becomes orderly, whole, it's called gravity in the natural world, erosion.
Right.
And cells mutate. There's no cell. It just doesn't a cell, right? As soon as it forms, it starts to split.
Right. But we as human beings have this uncanny desire to always fix permanence.
Why?
Because we come to love and desire. It gets back to that desire, that dukkha, that we desire to have the things that we have right now and to keep them and to hold on to them so tight. It's why we fear death so much as well, is that we want to hold on to our own selves. And and inevitably, it's when we embrace the transitory that what makes the universe so beautiful, what makes it so unbelievably divine, is the fact that it is constantly changing, constantly evolving, and that it's transitory in nature. Even we don't even notice it, but that's the beauty of like the seasons. Go up and watch, you know, if you've lived in the mountains long enough, and I was fortunate enough to do so, that you watch as the, you know, September, it's why September is such a wonderful time of the year, is you start to watch day by day by day. If you notice, I used to teach at Vail Mountain School, and I don't know how I lucked into it in my first year there, but I had a beautiful view of looking out over the Vail Valley, and you would watch each and every single day as more and more of the leaves up on the hill would change. And it made you recognize that the world doesn't all of a sudden change in a heartbeat, that it slowly evolves. It's the beauty of like watching a canyon develop over thousands and thousands and millions of years.
Isn't the exact same process happening in nature right now?
Oh, absolutely.
The budding of the leaves.
Right. It comes on the other side of the cycle as well.
Because now life is there. And right. You take that philosopher, the concept of if you look at a bloomed flower, okay, right. My tulips, crocuses are coming up. The gladiolus, also known as the guy in Greek mythology kept looking at his face.
Narcissus.
The narcissist, okay. The flower. They're starting to come up.
I only know narcissists because I am one.
So I've noticed. No, I'm just kidding. But they're starting to come up now.
Right.
Okay. But what they are is potential fertilizer for the petunias that might go in there a little bit later. Right. And all of those are potential fertilizer for, but then once these flowers die, you mentioned September, right. The changing of the leaves, okay, things are dying and everything. What that is sustenance. It's going back into the earth for life to begin anew after the winter months, which is what's happening right now up here.
Right. Death and life are not opposites. And this gets back to the idea of seemingly contradictory things are not mutually exclusive. That death and birth are not opposites. They are, in fact, just different sides of the same coin. It's why if you ever, I have kids now, so I love watching, but we've seen the movie The Lion King. It's if you ever have watched the film, it is actually in some ways deeply philosophical and has this idea where they're talking about the circle of life. I love that movie. I used to show it to my students as a way to get them to start to see some of the seedlings of Eastern philosophy. Mm-hmm. We think of death as tragic, but it is through death, the death of one thing, that other things inevitably are born and bloom out of that. And our death is what, if no one ever died, how long would this planet be sustainable? It is my death that inevitably makes the way for other people to come after me. And that's the beauty of life, is that, but we, of course, we don't like things to change. And we have this huge attachment to ourselves and to the people that we love. And as such, that death of those things is, deeply painful for us.
And we're going to take a momentary, come up for air to do a station identification. So, hey, everyone, this is Jerry Fabianic on KYGT LPFM 102.7, 103.9, broadcasting to you in stereo from the center of the universe. That's in Clear Creek County, Colorado, downtown Idaho Springs, in the Goat Shack. Here visiting with Stephen Craig, author of Waiting for Tomorrow and...
Waiting for Today.
What did I say? Are we waiting for tomorrow or today?
I think it's right now.
Oh, I thought it was yesterday. I'm waiting for yesterday. I'm sorry. I'm so glad you corrected me.
Waiting for Yesterday is going to be the sequel.
Waiting for Yesterday. Yeah, exactly. And I'm just sitting on that rock. Time hasn't caught up to me yet. Now that would be intriguing to write. But before we go on with this intriguing, fun conversation, a couple of PSAs. Saturday, April 30th, 2016, cities around the nation will be partaking in a prescription drug take back. That's prescription. The Idaho Springs Police Department and local members of the Colorado Mounted Rangers, Colorado Statewide Law Enforcement Auxiliary will be staffing a collection station at the Idaho Springs City Hall, 17th and Minor, between 10 and 2 o'clock. That's next Saturday, April 30th. Drop-off location will be the East Curb, 17th, and on the west side of, it's just better. Just find City Hall at 17th and Minor. You'll see it. All right. The site will accept narcotics and controlled substances, prescription medications, including pills, inhalers, creams, ointments, and patches, as well as over-the-counter medications. The site will also accept pet medications. This is a no-question-asked program. If you got any more questions, please contact Chris Malanka at the Idaho Springs Police Department by 67-4291. Later this evening, in a couple hours, if you're listening to this original broadcast on April 23rd, Gypsy Cattle Drive and Mason Town is at the United Center. That's $12 at the door. You can buy tickets ahead of time, save $2, or just pay the $12 while you're there. What the heck? It says also you can go to Two Brothers and the Georgetown Library and get tickets there ahead of time. And one other, this was handed to me a little while ago, so I missed it earlier. So 2 weeks from today, May 7th, from 9 till noon at Bojo's Restaurant in Idaho Springs, there's a workshop on civil discourse, learn skills to enable civility in tough conversations. What if we learn to see something of value in everyone's position? What if we listen and understand why something is important to someone else and they understand what is important to us? What if we seek common interest instead of defending positions? All right, a whole lot more here. You can get more information if you want to call Etta Satter at 674-0633, or you can contact Etta through email, etta@ettasatterypottery.com, or Michael Leary, he's the president of the student body at Clear Creek High School, by the way, and his number is 720-648-4696, or mpatrickoleary, he's most Irish, by the way, at gmail.com. This is brought to you by the Clear Creek Democrats, but it is a nonpartisan event. Please reserve your seat by May 5th, so we're sure to have enough materials for everyone. So we're getting that out more informational-wise, but again, a workshop on civil discourse. So,
gosh, the universe could use more of that.
Imagine that.
Especially if this political season hasn't convinced us of the need for more civil discourse, even with people that we agree with, disagree with. I think that as you were reading that, Jerry, I just couldn't help but think about how this year has been just absolutely mind-boggling in terms of the descent down from what used to be the civil discourse. Even when I was a kid, and you're obviously a couple years older than me, but our nation has gone downhill in our ability to even to have the discussion with people we don't necessarily see eye to eye with.
It is so frustrating. And my article next week in Clear Creek Current is about, and I lay a lot of this on the male gender, that raising the voice, intimidation, the waving of the hands, a finger pointing at someone else's, it's aggressive in that to try to intimidate. When one is doing that, because I don't see women doing this, he is not listening, prepared to listen. He's there to preach. It's almost like the Messiah, Savior sort of thing here. I have the truth, the evidence, and I have had it with grumpy, crusty, old man, crotchety old man who just want to scream and point and yell over the top of everyone else.
I think you might be alluding to a couple or one person in particular.
There's a couple of them at the top there, but but anyway, we're not talking politics.
I too, just to quickly go off on that before we get back, but I do, I write a blog. It's also available on my website, waitingfortoday.com, and the blog I write twice a week. It comes out on Tuesdays and Fridays. It's called Truth in 1,000 Words or Less. So I try to not beat you over the head for more than 1,000 words. I figure that's enough for one quick read. And, but I have tackled that exact topic just a couple weeks ago about the descent. Regardless of which side of the political aisle you're on, it really has been this descent into we don't talk issues anymore. We literally sit there and try to bash people. Think about it, like in the last year that politics has descended into talking about each other's wives and size of certain body parts and whatnot. Cool. How this has become in any part relevant part of the political discourse, I don't know. And I think that's So I hope some people get out to the I hope some people get out to Bojo's and make it out to the a workshop on civil discourse. That sounds terrific.
Well, if you're available, it's welcome to everybody. So
I think I might be. I think I might attend.
Yeah, come on up. So, all right, let's go back to your story, though.
Yeah.
Waiting for not yesterday or tomorrow, but today.
Waiting for today. If you think about it philosophically, it all makes sense.
Yeah. And that line does come up, so
yep,
a little bit
does.
Of a spoiler alert, but it's wonderful when it's delivered and by the person. I want to talk about the characters.
Yeah.
Now, Jacob, the story finds its roots in the story of Job.
Right.
Why Jacob? Jacob was one of the patriarchs in the Old Testament.
Right.
Did you intentionally choose his name? Why?
Well, I thought that Job would have been just hitting you over the head with a stick, which, you know, I mean, would have been the argument. I did want it to be, I did want to make that biblical allusion to Job, but at the same time, and I did think of it when writing it as a modern retelling of the story of Job, in the sense that that the tremendous loss that both those, that's the parallel, of course, between Jacob and Job, is this tremendous loss of the things that really matter to you. And that's when your faith in for Job, it's faith in God. For Jacob, it's faith in the universe. It's a somewhat different concept of God. Yet at the same time, the idea of this universal, the universal composition of things. And so so both of them have their faith tested. As I said, when my kids are listening right now, or at least they better still be listening at this point. And so when I talked to them about it, I said, you know, when I was a kid, it was quite common for parents to say, when you were like, why? And your typical parent response was, because I said so. I hated that as a kid. And I find it immensely disrespectful. As a parent, I feel like we sometimes speak down to children as if their feelings or their thoughts matter less because they're younger. And I think that that's a load of BS. I think that their thoughts and feelings matter just as much as our own, and that every person deserves our universal respect. And part of universal respect is giving you a thoughtful response to that question, why? And I feel like that's the problem. And it was one of my problems in my own. And as I said, I love the struggle that Jonathan, your protagonist, goes through with his religious backgrounds. I went through a very similar one as a youth, in that I was a devout Christian at one point, devout. But inevitably questions came up to me, and the book of Job was one of them. In reading the book of Job, I went, wow, that is wholly dissatisfactory. Your answer to why we suffer is because you're God and you know things that we don't. Wow. Could you shed a little light? Maybe I'll try to understand. Why does God need to talk down to us and tell us that we're incapable of understanding it? And inevitably, that's what, as I said, when I got a little bit older and as I was going through those philosophical questionings about why do we suffer, I always found the answer that you get in the Bible through the book of Job to be inadequate. And I felt like there was an answer to that question. I felt like we as human beings could derive an answer. And I think that waiting for today is very much an attempt to answer that question.
What are your children's names?
Tobias and Acacia.
And how old are they?
Tobias is 9, and Acacia is her 7th birthday is coming up in just a couple weeks.
Yay!
Hey, sweet pea.
Well, hi, Tobias and Acacia. So.
And we can't forget JD and Luke. My girlfriend is listening with her sons as well, so they're out there as well.
Nice. Okay. And they're listening because you told them to do so?
Because I told them that they had to.
They're going, Dad!
No, in fairness, they just said that they genuinely wanted to listen. Now, whether they'll listen to the thing or not.
I'm sure they're, and I mean this in a very enraptured by it, because it's going to be a great conversation, not only now as children, but in a couple, 3 years. You taught high school, you're there at that level.
Absolutely.
And even middle school, when the brain growth starts to grow, and you're going to have this recording, they're going to have this book. This is fodder for them in classrooms. I just love this.
Well, to be honest, like, it's interesting. My son came to me a while back. This is a really cool story. Tobias is still listening. And it goes to show you that, and this is why, young people deserve our respect every bit as much. They have those thoughts going on. It's harder for them to find the language to articulate it. But it doesn't mean that they haven't had the thoughts and the rumblings in there already. And I was talking to my son Tobias, and I've both my ex and I have been very adamant about raising them with a freedom of making their own philosophical and religious choices. That I don't want to define that for them. I want them to find, because I genuinely believe that any path of belief is one that one walks on one's own. It's a very Buddhist idea of that. And so I always wanted that for him. And so in any case, he came and asked me if he could go to church with one of his friends. And I said, absolutely. And I said, you know, my only hesitation is here's why. I just don't want you to feel any pressure. You know, I don't want, because your friend believes it or because you go and hear something, that you feel pressured towards that, going that path either. And he turned to me and said, you know, Dad, I really believe that a lot of, he's like, I'd like to just see it for myself. He's like, but I really believe that a lot of the reason that kids are quote unquote Christian is because that's what their parents told them to be. And this
is
from a 9-year old that he's already understanding the social programming that goes on, and how inevitably even things as important as what we believe and whether or not there's an afterlife, all those things are social constructs that inevitably why we believe them is not because we've gotten there ourselves. And that's the same thing I did as an educator. So I really believed that like somebody who's lifting weights, when you lift weights, you're tearing down the muscle so that it can build back stronger. Well, as an educator, that's our job, is to tear down the thoughts and the preconceived concepts that your students walk into the door with, not in order to make to take those thoughts away, but to help them build them back on their own. That this is what I believe because this, I have questioned it, and in questioning it, I have come to believe it all the more so, and whatever that might be. Remember years ago, I was teaching a course called World Literature and Philosophy to seniors at an East Coast boarding school. And at the end of it, part of that class, I taught the musical Jesus Christ Superstar, which is a great musical, by the way. If those of you not Andrew Lloyd Webber fans, that is just a tremendous. He wrote it when he was 19. And in any case, you know, it basically asked the idea of what if Jesus Christ was just a man? And I had a student come up to me, and we're still friends on Facebook, and he came up to me after graduation and said, I have to tell you, Kreggers, that when you taught me that, but when we went over that, I wanted to hit you in the face for question. He's like, I'm a devout Catholic. And he's like, and I wanted to hit you right in the head for having the blasphemy to question my Catholic beliefs. And he's like, now I want to take you out and buy you a beer because you got me to question that. And it's because of that that my faith is all the stronger.
And because you're not only, it's like tilling the soil.
Right.
So you used a
metaphor
of the, the leaves. When the September they fall, we till them under, it puts nutrients back in, and then you throw the seeds. And that's what we did as teachers. You still do. I don't anymore. I do now in this format, but certainly not in a classroom. But you throw seeds out there, and that parable in the Bible about when the farmer goes out and throws the seeds, some fall on rock, some fall in the thistle, some fall in fertile ground.
Right.
And you never know where it's going to fall and how they're going to grow. And so, you know, I that was one of the lessons I learned early in my career. I was just a young pup and sitting with an old veteran at happy hour. And I said, you know, Neil, I just want to see how my students will turn out someday. And he said, well, first of all, they're not your students. And he started doing the math for me. He said, how many teachers between, you know, kindergarten and just high school graduations have they gone through their classes, you know, themselves? And, you know, maybe they only have one or two in first, second grade. Okay, by the time they get to eighth grade, they've had at least 10 or 12. Okay, then they get to high school, and, you know, that easily triples, you know, 30, 40 different ones. And you never know, because they're sitting in one classroom, 30 approximately children sitting in there. You're one person at one moment of time. And then they got their coaches, their ministers, their priests, and all the other adults, their parents are their primary teachers. They're not your students. And yet, there's that one who come back to you on Facebook.
Right.
And not only what I love here, he didn't say Mr. Craig. He said, Kreggers, you have a name. That's your identity.
Yes.
That's my students called me Fabes.
Right.
That was it right there. It's just Fabes. And it'll always be Fabes. They will never be able to call me Jerry. Okay. And it's always going to be Fabes because there's that power of teacher and everything. But you were helpful, you know, to allow them to start finding their way. And if he goes back to Catholicism, bless you, great.
Right.
But at least you do so with reason and understanding.
I'm fine with what literally if that is going to be the premise of your philosophy that you're as an educator is that you are open, you want them to find their own path, you have to be absolutely okay with the idea that it might not be yours. In fact, celebrating the fact that it's not, I could care less what faith. I've taught at two Catholic schools, not Catholic by any stretch of the imagination, and love that about it, and love the fact that, I wouldn't have taught at those schools were they not incredibly liberal and open-minded in terms of what the freedom that they gave me to teach. But it was exactly because of that that those students, I think, came and had inevitably came to question those ideals. And then inevitably where they went from there was up to them. And that to me is what's powerful as an educator.
Yeah. And, I want to go back to the characters whose story go through them. But there's one other aspect. I don't know if you thought of this. And I was just going to touch on Jacob because I want to go on to the others.
Great.
Because Jacob, I don't know if you're familiar with this story in the Old Testament. The wrestling with an angel.
Well, so continue. I want to hear where you're going with that.
Need to read that. It's in Genesis, I think it's 32 or something like that. Find that piece where during a dream in there, he's wrestling with an angel. That's a metaphor. What is he wrestling with? Is it his belief in God, whatever?
Right.
But he's struggling with what is that that we, yet it's almost like perhaps coming off of my story, Sisyphus pushing the rock up the hill, right. Wrestling with the angel, whatever. So I am just going to suggest that there's deeper meaning to your character, Jacob.
Yes.
Because when I read it, that was my first concept, or not concept, but perspective on Jacob there. And I immediately went to that there, and I could see that
parallel.
Struggle for him in that story. That's a powerful motif.
That's a really good point, Jerry. And that's why at the end of the novel, it comes back to a poet that you, the religious poetry of John Donne, which you also refer to in your novel Sisyphus Wins. I love John Donne, and John Donne's personal story is fantastic. Mm-hmm. And I allude to it. I'll urge you to read my novel as a way to get to John Donne's story. But John Donne, of course, wrestled with faith like no other writer to some degree that I've ever encountered. It's so painstakingly real in the Holy Sonnets for him. And I think that it's inevitably what that struggle is, or the way that I would read that struggle is the struggle between reason and faith. Mm-hmm. That inevitably faith is believing in things which the senses tell you not to. Mm-hmm. And those two things, reason and faith, are butt up against each other. And it's important sometimes to have faith in the things that you don't see.
That is amazing.
Yeah.
His first wife, Faith, is itself intentionally named.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There you go.
it was in some sense, I thought of the novel as allegorical.
Absolutely.
And so it was okay to use the name that was sort of, obviously symbolic.
Mm-hmm. And then, the daughter.
Aurora.
It's Aurora.
No, it's not. It's not predicated on the idea of the town down in Denver. No, the Aurora is, of course, the idea of it's the. If you go back to the Greeks, it's the term for dawn or reawakening, mm-hmm. and that idea of and again, it's that getting back to that dichotomy between light and dark. Mm-hmm. Dawn is that time where it's shifting from the darkness back to the light. And so so his daughter was, that was the attempt at that name, was to try to see that, and she is part of what helps him to see his way through the tragedy. Mm-hmm. It's at his moment of darkest tragedy that he realizes the blessing that he's been given with a child. Mm-hmm. And so it's in that, her name is incredibly symbolic with the idea of trying to bring him back to the light. And I love her as a character. She's probably, if you asked me who my favorite character in the book is, it's her. She's modeled after no specific one student, although there's probably a bunch of them out there listening, hoping it is them. but rather it's based off of some of the amazing young people that I've gotten to teach. I love teenagers. Teenagers tell it like it is,
Yeah. And I'm with you on that. And by the way, and folks, when you read this book, when I say when, not if, but when you do, hone in on it. You're right. I think you develop Aurora as an archetype high school. That's immediately what I got into,
right.
That type. We both have that experience in a classroom, and you could just see, you know, like 16 different student aspects in this one. It's like, well, like this. She's a very powerful character, the way she delivers her lines, her presence, everything there, her role in the story. His mother. What's her name?
Her mother's Elizabeth. His mother's Elizabeth. And that was not. That's interesting about why Elizabeth. There wasn't that was not as much so. It's interesting that his mother is as close to of all the characters in the book is as close to real for me, and not in the sense of literally true. But in the sense more that my mom, I oftentimes feel has gone down that road at times of not seeing the beauty and the light in life, and instead focusing on the darkness and allowing herself to be a martyr of her own self pity.
Yeah, I'm going to do a spoiler alert, so I'm not going to say what it is. But there's a great line. It's a very simple line at the end.
Yeah.
That she delivers to Jacob, but it is powerful. When you sit there and think about it in her character and the way you develop it and what she does in the story.
Right.
So just when people are reading through, just a heads up there when you get there to spend some time with that. That's important. I just think of both Elizabeth in the Old Testament again, because you got Jacob.
Right.
You're drawing on that Old Testament, whereas with Faith and Aurora, you have now gone into the New. And then his girlfriend is?
Angie.
What's her real name? Angie is a form of?
Angel. Right. Oh, yeah, absolutely. And to some degree or another, she rescues him from his own miring and self-pity and martyrdom. And inevitably, it's through Angie that he is redeemed and delivered again to the universe. And that was intentional.
Mm-hmm.
But she too, I love her character. She's spirited and feisty, and those are I've had the benefit in my life of being surrounded by between my grandmother, my mother, I've been surrounded by some really incredibly powerful women in my life, and Angie to some degree or another encapsulates all of them.
Well, you have a very powerful work, Steve.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Yeah.
Much appreciated.
And it's a work I'm really going to encourage. I am encouraging people to read and consider, reflect on, reread. There's some great lines there because it's applicable. It's something we can all find. We all struggle. We all wrestle with the angel in different ways and face loss and tragedy. And we fall into that pit and abyss of self-pity. And how do we extract ourselves? How do we move beyond it? And then just answering questions of faith, you know, why are we born to suffer and to die? I will encourage everyone to go dig out, if you can find copies of Venus on the Half Shell by Kilgore Trout. He answers it for you at the end.
Spoiler alert.
Kilgore Trout, Venus on the Half Shell. You have to read it. Kurt Vonnegut.
I love Kurt Vonnegut.
Yeah.
Kurt Vonnegut's a great guy. I met him years ago. He came and spoke at Colgate when I was at school. And he was a great, 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 great man and a great writer.
Oh, phenomenal. Well, you're brilliant. So
thank you. Thank you for having me. I really appreciate the opportunity. It was wonderful being here.
Your website again?
My website is waitingfortoday.com. So just the title of the book, waitingfortoday.com. Go. You can read excerpts of the book. You can I'll put a link on here if you want to listen to this again. And also you can read my blog as well as get a feel for the writing that I do outside of just novels. And I am working on a second. So
awesome.
Yeah.
Oh, that's exciting.
Not a sequel, though. I promise you it's not Waiting for Tomorrow or Waiting for Yesterday, I promise.
Or the day after. Or for last year. Yes, we yearned for our past. It's like, oh, poor me, I'm getting old.
Isn't that Gatsby born back ceaselessly into the past?
Yes. You know, well, of course you can.
Yeah.
You know, you can't repeat the past. Of course you can. What a great line.
Oh,
Gatsby.
I love you and I. Oh. We should come back and do this again and just do Gatsby.
Oh,
to me,
you're right.
To me, Gatsby is far and away, you know. one of the things I get asked as a writer is who do you aspire to? Now that doesn't mean who you think you are, because if thought I was F. Scott Fitzgerald, but that to me is the epitome of great novel writing. The character development, and to the point where then when when Nick Carraway as the narrator, writes that line of, we were born back ceaselessly in the past, it echoes with tremendous meaning and profound statement. And I hope to some degree or another, you were talking about my book's importance. I really do. I hope we've all suffered to some degree in life. We've all undergone tragedies, whatever scale that might be. And I do. I believe that Waiting for Today will make you believe in life again. If you're out there and you're looking for a book that will inspire you to believe in life again, I hope that you will. You go to my website, waitingfortoday.com. It's available on Amazon, available at some of your local booksellers in town as well. So,
awesome. All right. So, great. Stephen Craig, thanks again. And we'll be obviously talking more. Because now we got a couple shows we're going to be doing here. We might just have I might have a co-host here too.
I may be back though, just in case of
You got it. Okay, so once again, thanks everyone. This is Jerry Fabianic on KYGT LP FM 102.7, 103.9, and I want to thank Dex for sponsoring this hour of Writer's Talk on the Rabbit Hole. I'm going to be back in 2 weeks on May 7th. Still arranging the second half, but our state representative, Casey Becker, will be with us, and she's going to talk about what's happening in the legislature and how that's all wrapping up. So 2 o'clock, and perhaps Stephen might be back or some other author, and we'll talk about that on May 7th. So, and this show is being recorded. We'll have it up on the website, probably by Monday, on the radio's website, on mine. It'll be on Stephen's, so it's going to be everywhere. So, and of course, it'll be rebroadcast on Monday at 3 o'clock. The whole show starts at 2, that first part there. So, all right, I'm going to be closing up shop here, and we're already after 4 o'clock. It's okay. So, we'll do a little bit of continuation of music, and I'll be back in 2 weeks, as I say. All right.